The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap.
In today's episode, Major Eric Chaya sits down with Major Tim Marty and Major Bobby Strain to discuss their joint thesis examining the potential need for amphibious aircraft to support operations in the Indo-PACOM AOR. Their ongoing research aims to inform the potential for DoD investment in amphibious aircraft.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Major Eric Chaya. I'm your Trident Room podcast host today. And with me, I have Major Tim Marty and Major Bobby Strain, two Air Force pilots, fellow defense analysis students, who have a really cool thesis idea that I would like to talk about today. But before we get into that, I'd like to give you guys an opportunity to go over your background throughout the Air Force. And let's start with Bobby.
Hi, Eric. So I'm Major Bobby Strain. I graduated 2011 from the Colorado School of Mines. Then I went to pilot training, and following pilot training, I had the opportunity to go fly the C-5 for a couple of years. And that was an amazing aircraft, you know, one of the biggest in the world. And it was a very unique experience being able to travel the globe, one night staying in a resort-type location, and the next night staying in Afghanistan, getting mortared. It was very interesting type of environment to be in, especially as a young captain being responsible for a crew and a large aircraft going around the world doing these missions. And then following that, I went over to the Contingency Response Group, unique mission set within the Air Force where we open up air bases for humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, or combat operations. And then after that, I went on to fly the KC-135 out of England, providing all of the air refueling for Europe and Africa. So that was kind of my history prior to coming to NPS and here in defense analysis.
Okay, so two different airframes, right? What are some of the uniqueness of both of them? Obviously, they have two different jobs. One of them has a really cool boom in the back and you're probably pretty comfortable, but what are some of the differences and what'd you like about?
Both were awesome mission sets. Going in the C-5, going worldwide, bringing pretty much a whole town with you, a crew of 10 to 20 people, all that cargo, just taking it wherever it needs to go. That was very unique. Some of the places we got to visit and stay. For the KC-135, though, that was a very unique mission set, too, where you're a little more connected to the warfighter. You're out there giving gas to fighters, bombers, ISR platforms, and you're a little more connected there. And it's a very unique experience with that, too, is everybody loves tankers. Everybody needs tankers, but nobody talks about tankers. And it's interesting, two ends of the logistics spectrum there from the air side, very unique. I loved both of them. And so both have a very fond place in my heart.
Yeah. I mean, you get to fly. I mean, at the end of the day, that's like, how cool is that? As an infantryman/special forces guy, you know, looking up at you guys, I was always like pretty jealous of, I'm like, man, that would be really cool. It's probably climate controlled up there is what I was usually thinking.
Yes, it's very nice. It was a childhood dream come true, so I can't complain. I'm living the dream here. So
that is a question that I was going to have for both of you. Is that something you guys always wanted to do? But Bobby, for you, I mean, is it childhood dream come true, huh?
Yeah. One of my buddies in elementary school, his dad was an Air Force pilot and then went to fly for the airlines. And just hearing his stories really intrigued me and made me want to pursue flying in the Air Force. And that's kind of what vectored me towards becoming a pilot. And looking back, I'm glad that happened.
All right, Tim, over to you.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Eric. We very much appreciate this opportunity. So similar to Bobby, I graduated from college in 2011. I attended the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, did the ROTC program there for the Air Force, and commissioned in 2011. Didn't activate until 2012, though, but went straight to pilot training. And out of pilot training, I was assigned U-28s, which most people don't know what that is. Neither did I when I was assigned the aircraft, but it is an Air Force Special Operations Command ISR platform. It's a modified Pilatus PC-12. So I spent the beginning of my career flying ISR orbits, mostly over Iraq and a little bit of Africa as well. And then I did have an opportunity to go fly some other AFSOC airplanes for a little bit and then ended up at Naval Postgraduate School.
Yeah, the U-28, really cool platform. We got to work with them quite a bit in Afghanistan and Yeah, you're right. I don't think a ton of people know much about them. And there's probably not a whole lot we can talk about in here. I think that's safe to say. But a unique experience, any cool story, any challenging situation, something when you look back at your experience, that maybe that was unique as a U-28 pilot that other pilots maybe didn't experience.
Yeah, specifically for the U-28, what was unique about that is some things I can talk about. There are full motion video cameras that we operate. They're two different sensors. And between a crew of four, there are two sensor operators, one of which is the combat systems operator. He or she is a primary sensor operator for the larger of the two cameras. But the second camera, a little bit smaller, operated by the co-pilot. So once we get on orbit, the co-pilot stops flying, if you will, and transitions to being a sensor operator. So you pull out a different set of screens and literally a keyboard in my lap instead of focusing on the yoke and of everything. So all the flying responsibilities goes to the left seat and you're operating a sensor just like an RPA sensor operator or the guy behind you. So it was a very unique opportunity where you learn how to fly, but you're also learning how to operate a sensor and talk on the radio to a ground team or to a ISR tactical controller, people like that. So it was a lot of fun, very interesting experience.
Yeah, I mean, it is absolutely unique, as we keep saying. Well, we're all here at the Naval Postgraduate School living the dream, and I just wanted to take a moment to hear how, maybe why, you're here. Why did you come to the Naval Postgraduate School? And we'll start with Tim.
Sure. I came to Naval Postgraduate School through a little bit of a roundabout way, but I applied.
Didn't we all?
Yes, yes. A little bit. Normal timeline for ILE for the Air Force. So I applied. I was actually an alternate, so I didn't get picked up initially. But then within AFSOC, they send five additional folks outside of the school select list to come specifically to defense analysis. So somebody had dropped out on the original list, and I got picked up as an alternate. And all I knew was Monterey was a very nice place, and I wanted to go learn something from a very nice school.
I was originally scheduled to go to Maxwell, Alabama for Air Command and Staff College, and I got a phone call one day asking if I wanted to go to NPS in Monterey, California, and do it for 18 months rather than a year in Alabama. I knew nothing about defense analysis or really anything about Naval Postgraduate School other than it was Monterey, California. But that sounded good enough to me. I started doing some research. And ever since then, I think I made the best decision I could have at the time.
Yeah, I'm sure Kristen and the kids don't mind being out here.
Absolutely. She was overjoyed when I asked her if you'd rather go to California by the beach rather than hot Alabama.
Yeah, nowhere else, at least as far as I'm tracking, no other ILE type school can you do things like this where you get the hands-on training that we've been able to get.
You guys have a really cool thesis that I want to start talking about here. But first, could you talk about, did you guys know each other before this? And then once you guys got here, just talk about in the nascent phases, how you two got together and thought that you would write about seaplanes.
About 10 years ago, we went to initial flight screening together. And that whole experience is a whole nother topic to discuss. But it was a whirlwind of training and learning all this stuff. But we briefly met there. And then 10 years went by and you show up at NPS and you look at someone and you go, I think I know you. And so that's kind of how it started.
Yeah. And then as we were talking about thesis ideas, we're kind of back and forth. Both of us wanted to do something. Ideally, we were thinking we both wanted to be stationed in Hawaii. So we started talking, hey, maybe we'll do a dual thesis on something in the Pacific to get us out to Hawaii for our next duty station. That led us towards focusing on the Pacific and towards this thesis.
Okay, so you're thinking about future challenges in maybe the Indo-PACOM AOR. How do you come to seaplanes?
At lunch one day, we were talking a little bit. We had gone out. We were part of the Nimitz research group as well. So they took us out to Hawaii and we got briefed by a bunch of different stakeholders out there on what they're having issues with. And every one of them said logistics. One of the key issues out there was logistics.
It was one of those situations where we wanted to help with some type of operational problem, but combine that with something that we are also passionate about. Of course, flying is a really fun job to do. And we thought, well, we can't solve the whole logistics problem in the Pacific, but we're pilots, so we'll focus on maybe air support. And then I think just the nature of the Pacific, airplane that could land on water made sense to us. Yeah. So we wanted to dive into that and see if it can't fill some type of capability gap somewhere.
Our first quarter, Professor Gunnar Sepp, he brought up a previous thesis where they were focusing on the next ISR platform, and the students got qualified in a tail dragger airplane, and we thought that was really cool. tailwheel airplane. And we're like, well, that's not really what our focus is. Maybe our focus should be seaplanes to help with logistics, and kind of built it up from there.
And it kind of started out as a joke at first of, oh, maybe we should go get a seaplane qual. Yeah. And slowly we started talking more and more about it. We even met with the department head to say, hey, we'd like to do these things. It's a matter of funding. Can you help us build an argument? And
in my experience, it has been just being able to say that I'm a master's student at the Naval Postgraduate School. Are you willing to hear me? Do you want to listen to this? I think I have an idea that for your organization could be groundbreaking. And I've been met with open arms with this as a platform. Can you guys speak to your experience?
It was a little hit and miss. Some people we were talking to and they loved it, but then they said, we don't have funding to support. Come back with us, or we'd love to see your research at the end, but we don't have funding to support any of the travels or the qualifications. Other people were kind of soured by it because of the recent amphibious MC-130 attempts that the Air Force had. They didn't go so well, and really it proved problematic as they were trying to make the C-130 amphibious. From that, we learned a lot of stuff that we even have in our paper, that there's diminishing returns with the size of floats, and you really need something designed for operations on the ocean if you're trying to do that. But as we were going and pitching our idea to different people, some people were extremely receptive, a lot of different stakeholders as we were going around, and some people were kind of soured by the MC-130 attempt and that discussion, as well as a lack of funding. Then eventually, Tim found a partnership with AFSOC A3F.
It just was a matter of time until you get 106 to say, yes, I will support that, and I'll give you some money to go get your seaplane qualification.
Just one yes, and then you have the golf check. Very cool.
So we were able to do that. We spent about a week in Louisiana with a very capable and knowledgeable instructor, Southern Seaplanes. It was very basic qualification, but we were able to get into an airplane and take off and land on water. So it was a lot of fun.
You said you talked to an 06, but that doesn't just happen as you guys are sitting tucked away in the Dougley Knox Library just talking about this. Can you explain how you went about getting this? It sounds like Dr. Malkasian was able to help you guys out, but talk to me about how proactive you had to be to make this happen.
Yeah, you have to be proactive, and that it starts with just talking to different people about it, to include your professors is a good place to start, which for us, it was Brian Greenshields. He's one of the faculty members who was in the Air Force. And so he had a good understanding of we wanted to do something regarding airplanes in the Pacific. And he introduced us to a symposium that was being held at Hurlburt Field called the Special Air Warfare Symposium. And so he offered up us to go. I was the only one able to go just due to scheduling conflicts. But there was a lot of different high-ranking folks from SOCOM and AFSOC. And it was just literally stepping up to folks and saying, sir, ma'am, my name's Tim, MPS student. This is what I'm trying to do. Can you help us out?
So you mentioned Gunnar Sepp. I think anyone who's been in class with him has left inspired. I know I have. Were there some inspirational case studies, some historical uses of this that you guys looked at and said, this is something that we can use as an example and either tweak, get better? What do you think, Bobby? Go ahead.
So actually, as we were researching this, the very first planes delivered to the U.S. Navy in 1911 were actually amphibious aircraft. And beyond that, they were widely used in both World War I, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam by the Air Force and the Navy, primarily fulfilling search and rescue, anti-submarine warfare, logistics, and CASAVAC roles. A couple of those interesting facts, though. The PBY Catalina in World War II sunk over one-third of the submarines worldwide. So one-third of the submarines sunk worldwide in all theaters were sunk by the PBY Catalina in World War II.
I had no idea. That's incredible.
Additionally, some of these seaplanes, so the Catalina, they were the first airplanes launched during the Battle of Midway, sinking some of the ships, some of the Japanese ships there as they were moving for the battle. So that was kind of interesting to see the impact, the significant role they had during World War II. Those are just some of the small cases. Additionally, for non-standard logistics chains, about 75% of the uranium from the Little Boy bomb dropped on Hiroshima actually originated in Gabon, Africa, and it was secretly brought over by the Pan Am Clipper, and then in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, kind of used to build up the capability to have that bomb. Seaplanes are now proliferated around the Pacific, and some sort of non-standard logistics chains could also be used for similar capabilities in that to support any sort of operations we have there that are more sensitive in nature as well.
Yeah, there's an idea of what's old is new again, bringing back more antiquated technology, if you will.
Time-tested.
Time-tested. However, seaplanes are still going to be vulnerable to the same things that even modern aircraft are. I think where they really play a huge role is not being reliant on a land-based infrastructure and having that flexibility of landing. Again, there's limitations to the water state and all that stuff, but theoretically, almost anywhere that there is a water surface could be a place where you could set down an asset and then do some type of activity.
What do amphibious aircraft offer us as the DoD?
I think one of the biggest things that they offer is runway independence. That's kind of the one of the buzzwords of AFSOC, where we're concerned about operating in remote locations that may not have the best infrastructure, dispersed operations. There's a lot of different little islands throughout the Pacific. And so how do you move people and things to these places? There's lots of different ways to do that. But when we're talking about airplanes or air support, you're going to have to rely on some type of asset that can self-support, if you will. It's not reliant on something like a long, large runway. And helicopters are one option, of course. However, the Pacific AOR is very large, and there's just limitations to range and things of that nature. Seaplanes, depending on the variant, can provide additional logistics capability that does not rely on significant infrastructure wherever you're going.
Bobby, you want to add something to that?
Tim said it great. Amphibious aircraft really provide an extra option, more flexibility. The runway independence is going to be huge in the Pacific, and it's going to give potentially the U.S. one more asymmetric advantage if conflict does arise in the Pacific. One of our focus items with this is if we do have any conflict arise, how can we better support it? As we shift our focus back towards Indo-PACOM, a lot of the capability gaps that we're recognizing both on the SOF and the conventional side are the ability to support search and rescue, logistics, and ISR. With search and rescue, Indo-PACOM JPRC stated that the coverage is only about 16% of the theater right now due to range-limited assets. Utilizing seaplanes would increase this range. For example, the Japanese US-2 has approximately 3 to 4 times the range of a rescue helicopter and about 30 times the speed of a ship. With that, that can also be applied to logistics, whether you're talking about supporting dispersed ODAs or MSOTs. Or on the conventional side, the Marine EABOs, the Air Force ACE construct, or the Navy Distributed Maritime Operations, all of those provide unique logistics challenges. But beyond that, for the ISR realm, a lot of war games and recent studies have showed that our runways are easily targetable, and our ability to reconstitute airfields is definitely finite, especially when you're looking at large aircraft operations like the P-8 that potentially takes out the P-8 from conducting anti-submarine warfare operations.
What I think of is it's like a somewhat benign platform as well, right? I mean, it's commonly used. They're out there. What I thought was really neat about your guys' studies was it wasn't just in the classroom, that you guys decided you wanted to not just write about this, but go do it. Can you talk to me just about your experience and what drove you to do that?
Yeah, we wanted to really add the realism to our thesis rather than just going through the historical case studies, seeing what it was like in the past, actually knowing what it's like to fly the airplanes, to be able to land on water, take off from water. I feel like that added something to our thesis. And then also beyond that, the Japanese do have a seaplane that they're flying right now, the US-2. And we were able to go out to Japan and participate in a rescue flag exercise where we were able to fly along with them. I was actually rescued from the water from them.
An exercise rescue.
Yeah, exercise rescue. Yes, yes. But very unique capability. And we got to fly the simulator as well. So that was interesting getting the hands-on experience to see the true capabilities and limitations of seaplanes.
Yeah, it gives you that realistic understanding to say it on paper, maybe you'll get specifications of the aircraft and say, yeah, on paper it can do this, but getting that hands-on training and experience and exposure to these operations, you can paint the picture in a more realistic fashion to say, okay, in a practical manner, this is how it could actually or where it could actually work.
I mean, it absolutely makes sense to me that if you're going to write about something with as big of implications as this has, why would you not take the time to fully understand it? I imagine sitting in the cockpit and actually flying it, understanding, like you said, the limitations, capabilities, gives you a much better sense of when you're writing about it, what's in the realm of possible. The layer of depth that provides for you guys is going to come out in the writing, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Just echoing that, adding that with the history of amphibious aircraft and seaplanes, we were able to really paint a better picture. I hope, for our thesis and get the insider perspective.
I know as an ODA guy, with thinking of the capability to get resupply, essentially you're adding resilience. So we're not just reliant on door bundles out of these aircraft. If I am doing a mission in a coastal environment, or even if there's a large lake, you know, we spent time in Malawi, huge lake, Lake Malawi. And I just think about the potential there to resupply, to support, making it more joint.
That is a capability that you could put on a seaplane and have that provide that role. So really, these seaplanes, these amphibious aircraft, do have the ability to potentially be very effective in the fight.
Can you talk a little bit about what we can talk about in here as far as contested communications, whether that's GPS jamming? What does the seaplane offer us? When I think of one, I think it's somewhat rudimentary compared to what you guys are used to flying.
DARPA is working on their Liberty Lifter, which is a large seaplane. It's not going to be amphibious. It's only going to be able to take off and land on the water. However, one thing that they're saying is a huge benefit of seaplanes like their Liberty Lifter is if you're going low to the water, that kind of obscures the aircraft and the noise. So it makes it harder to pick up on radar, and it goes much faster than a ship, and it's much smaller than a ship too. So it's not as detectable. You can get in, get out quicker, and potentially be drowned out by the noise with the radar if you go low enough. So that's one capability. Yes, they're going to be susceptible to all the A2AD as well, really as the rest of the Air Force, right? As the rest of the air domain and the sea domain. However, that ability to come in low gives you some sense of stealth. It helps you from being detected.
Are you guys talking about landing these at night? Is there a team you set ahead of time? You know, we talk about whether it's a Pathfinder or a JTAC or someone qualified to man a runway.
Potentially, but if you look back in World War II, there was a squadron of Catalinas called the Black Cats. And without NVGs, they did night operations throughout the Pacific, open water, open ocean. And it took some training to get to that level. It took some risk acceptance. But they were able to do this all at night without NVGs. Now we have a lot more technology, a lot more capability. It was a valuable experience. And I think this could definitely be a capability that we have night flights from seaplanes. We think that the investment in seaplanes is not going to win the war alone for the U.S. and its allies. However, as we alluded to before with the Catalina in World War II sinking over one-third of the subs, it provides flexibility, it provides options, and it reduces the risk for the combatant commanders in the joint force, and provide an alternative to this, as we were talking about before, for the anti-submarine warfare role.
Well, I want to be respectful of everybody's time. We're coming toward the end here, so I just want to give you guys an opportunity, kind of open floor here. Some things you'd like to mention. You did mention some advice to future students. You mentioned some faculty and people who are able to help you out, but I just want to open up the floor for you guys if you want to mention anything else before we close out.
I have a list of thank yous that I'd like to throw out. Tim, did you want to say anything before we go to the thank yous?
Advice to students is just ask the questions and do what you're passionate about.
Yeah, for the thank yous, I mean, first and foremost, we'd like to thank our families. I know on my side, my wife and my three boys have been extremely supportive of our crazy ideas to pursue seaplanes here and go on various TDYs, meaning time away from home there. From the DA department, really would like to thank Professor Gunnar Sepp for helping us with our initial vector, kind of planting the seed there and inspiring us. Professor Michael Freeman for being an advisor throughout the process and really pushing us, giving us good vectors and showing us the way, as well as Professor Nick Dew providing the excellent inputs as our second reader. And beyond that, Brian Greenshields been extremely helpful getting us funding, getting us hooked up, connected with the right people. He connected us with Dr. Rick Newton, and he's been giving us some vectors as well, valuable insight. And also our department head, Professor Carter Malkasian, he's been invaluable as we've been bouncing ideas off to get this planted through. And Professor Gordon McCormick, wealth of knowledge, loves seaplanes, and has been very awesome as well. And really the whole DA department supporting us. And I know Tim wanted to.
Yeah, so I'll say thank you to my family as well. My wife gave birth 2 months ago, and she still was okay with me traveling around. So yeah, I'm very grateful for that. And then lastly, the 06 I alluded to earlier, it was a huge thanks to Colonel Mark Skipper Jones, AFSOC A3F. None of this would have been possible in terms of traveling and getting that hands-on experience without his help. We could have written a paper without doing any of this type of traveling and training. However, as we had talked about it, I think it really added a huge valuable insight in making a much better thesis in the end.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for your time. I appreciate it. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at TridentRoomPodcastHost@nps.edu.